So the things Jesus did. This is the new series. And today Jesus sets his face to Jerusalem. And you may thus far feel totally, I haven't got a clue what he's talking about. It's an unusual turn of phrase. And it's also interesting, isn't it? Things Jesus did. I mean, there's lots of other series that we could have thought about. We could have thought about things Jesus said. You know, there'd be lots of things there that'd be really important and that we could focus our attention on. Or we could have said people Jesus met. Or we could have maybe even said places Jesus went to. But no, we're thinking about the things Jesus did. And this is really important because, I like this image of the idea of post-its, and that there's some for chores, and some say do this, and some say do that. And I bet the chores one is the list that gets looked at least. Throughout his ministry, Jesus doesn't just point the way to happiness. He doesn't like stand back and say, it's over there, off you go, that way. I once went on a car treasure hunt that was a bit like that, and I don't think we certainly didn't find the treasure. We were hard-pressed to find our way back. It's not like that. Jesus leads the way. He's out in front. He's taking us with him. It's not just remote. It's not just, well, it's up to you guys. Off you go. Second left, third right, down the road, around the corner, and, you know. And, of course, the question is, he's not a pointer, he's a leader. And I wonder which category you would say you're in. Are you a pointer? Are you somebody who just points people which way to go? Or do you actually lead them? You know, it's all very well saying to somebody, oh yeah, I go to church, I go to Chart Baptist Church, it's down Holyrood Street, and you just walk a little way down and you go in there, and you'd be really welcome. I'm sure they'd love to see you. Or are you a leader who says, tell you what, I'll take you. Would you like to come with me? It's not so nerve-wracking then. And there's so many things in life where I'm left thinking, are we pointers or leaders? It's all very well saying to somebody, you really ought to change the way you do that. Or are we the sort of person that says, actually, I'll help you make a better cake? I hope you are. Throughout his atonement, Jesus leads us to love. Throughout his teachings, Jesus leads us to eternal truths. Through his perfect life, he leads us to the path of obedience. And this culminates, as Mark Kelsey puts it, in five things that Jesus did in 50 days. Sounds good, doesn't it? Five things, 50 days. When, of course, he was crucified, he was buried, he rose again, he ascended, and he sent us the Holy Spirit. So this time of preparation for us and for Jesus was really important, leading into those crucial 50 days. But before we get to those 50 days, and that will come obviously later, we get to a series of glimpses of things Jesus did leading up to that Easter narrative. So this is the first pericope. This is my new word for the week. Being a bit of an ignoramus and a wooden bear with a wooden brain, I didn't really know this word. Imagine as a grandparent saying to your grandchildren, shall we go up and have a bedtime pericope? It simply means story. So this is the first story in the section of Luke, sometimes called the travelogue to Jerusalem. Sounds like something from a travel agent, doesn't it? Jesus' journey to Jerusalem, and he's teaching his disciples to follow him. He's taking them with him. He's leading them so that they will in turn build the church. Sounds great. As an action plan, sounds brilliant. There's probably even some smart targets in there, you know, for measuring the success criteria. But it starts off with rejection. I wonder how the disciples felt about that. Jesus sets his face to Jerusalem. That's how the English Standard Version puts it. What on earth does that actually mean? Well, the English Standard Version, as I say, says, sets his face to Jerusalem. The King James Version says, steadfastly set his face. The NIV says, resolutely. The Message says, gathered up his courage and steeled himself for the journey. I quite like that. The New American Standard Version says, he was determined to go. And the Complete Jewish Bible says, he made his decision. There was no wavering, no flip-flopping. And the Good News Bible simply says, he made up his mind. Athletes, I think, are the best example of a resolute determination. You see them in the starting blocks, focused. They're not looking at the starter. They're not looking up, wondering when's the gun or the bang or whatever it is going to go. They're looking down the track. They are resolutely focused on the finishing line. Nothing is going to get in the way of that. We've all been there when sometimes that resolute determination seems really, really difficult. We've seen this clip before, but I just couldn't resist putting it in. Except I can't get to it. There we go. Oh. It's like me. It's feeling slow. I'll leave it to you, Joan. Are you able to get me back there?
Are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
Not yet.
Hey, are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
Yes.
Really?
No.
Are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
No, we are not.
Are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
Bit like how the disciples felt. You know, are we there yet? Are we at the crunch moment when you're going to drive out the Romans? Are we at the crunch moment when everybody's going to realize who you are and you're going to make it ever so clear and there's going to be a battle? They were on the wrong road, of course. I wonder when you've resolutely made a decision. I love dishwashers. I think they're really helpful. But the problem is, not everything can go in a dishwasher. You know, like the non-stick stuff, or the knives with bone handles, or, there just seems to be a whole load of stuff that you can't put in the dishwasher. And it accumulates on the worktop, until eventually you realize you've got to just set your face to washing it. Otherwise, you've run out of pots and pans or stuff. Or what about if you decide to resign or look for a new job? And eventually there comes a point where you say, I've just got to do this. I'm just not happy in where I am. Or, I need the promotion. I need to work. I've got to go and see the boss. I've got to have that discussion. Or what about if it's making amends or going to say sorry to somebody, which we prevaricate on and put it off and hang back until you reach the point where you say, it's no good. This is nagging and niggling and gnawing away at me. I'm just going to have to deal with it. They're decisions that are not easily made, and they're not lightly made, but they're made with implications. You know, if you don't do the washing up, then eventually you can't eat. If you don't sort out a problem at work, then you may end up off sick. If you don't say sorry to somebody, then a relationship is going to be wrecked. So thinking of the future, those five things in 50 days, they were known to Jesus. He knows all things. He knows about us. He knows about persecution. He knows that persecution and death awaited him. Yet he resolutely set his face to the journey. And when God gives us a course of action, how do we behave? Do we resolutely recognize that that's what God is saying to do? Or do we meet it with doubt and hesitation and 101 excuses as to why it couldn't possibly be me? He must be talking about somebody else. Do we experience trust or fear? The athlete has perfect trust that the starting gun will go. You know what I mean? They never line up and sort of think, well, I wonder if the starter's here. Have they arrived yet? Is it going to go? They know it will. That's the same sort of resolve and determination we need to have in our own Christian lives, rather than a fear, a doubt, a hesitation. And when we do feel doubtful, do we talk to Jesus about those things and how we feel, or do we just bottle it up and hope that we'll struggle through on our own? So anyway, it's all within that sort of context and that resolve that Jesus sets out for Jerusalem. And he decides to set out by the quickest and the shortest route. Well, wouldn't you? My sat-nav on my motorbike has quite an interesting dynamic between whether it goes the shortest route or the quickest route. I had to go to Somerton yesterday and I inadvertently went there the shortest route. It was a bit of a mistake, really. I've never been through so many windy, narrow lanes as opposed to the 303, which was the fastest route. Well, there were three routes between Galilee and Jerusalem. So Jesus is in Galilee and he's aiming for Jerusalem. So the first route would have been to go along the coast. The second route would have been to go through the Jordan Valley. Or the third route was the Central Ridge Road that wound north, through the passes in the mountains. And this was the fastest, the most direct. But it meant going through Samaria. Now, Jews usually avoided going through Samaria because there was so much enmity between Jews and Samaritans. It spanned centuries. It was, as far as the Jews were concerned, inhabited by idolatrous foreigners, non-Jews. They were people of mixed race. After their return from the Babylonian captivity, many worked to rebuild Jerusalem and their temple, whilst the Samaritans built a rival temple, which they dedicated to Jupiter. So the Jews regarded the Samaritans as their greatest enemies, sort of physically and spiritually. To the Jews, the Samaritans were the lowest of heathens. Anything to do with Samaria or Samaritans was held in just utter contempt. And that's the route that Jesus selects. Now, of course, this was not Jesus' first trip to Samaria. If you think about it, Luke 4 tells us the story of Jesus meeting the Samaritan woman at the well in the town of Sychar. That is on the map somewhere, but I can't even read it on this there, but you might be able to see it there. Oh yeah, in the middle there. I might even be able to give you a there. Okay, Sychar. But Luke says that Jesus had to, or needs must, take this route. Perhaps it was faster, but surely on that occasion it was because Jesus had an appointment, a divine appointment with that woman. In this instance, Jesus has sent messengers ahead to a town in Samaria, and their job is to make preparations. Now, preparations are good, aren't they? You know, plan, prepare, perform. That's what we're all told. But these are preparations for him. Perhaps they're to announce that Jesus is coming to teach, or maybe they've got to arrange for food and lodgings. But whatever their goal, the locals reject them. Now, maybe the villagers don't want to listen to Jesus' teaching. Maybe they're refusing to provide lodging for the group, even though that would break a sacred cultural obligation for hospitality. Maybe they just don't want to have anything to do with this group who are not from Samaria. But what's interesting, if we turn this around, is that whilst normally very accepting of Samaritans, Jesus actually shocks his disciples by barely noticing the Samaritans as he just keeps going straight through. He's so concentrated on the upcoming destination. The Samaritan villagers did not receive him because his face was set towards Jerusalem. Did they reject Jesus, or did they not host him overnight because he was so resolute on that journey? You know, when like you have visitors come to stay, perhaps family, and you say, oh, you know, would you like to stay an extra night? And say, no, we must get back for work on Monday, or, you know, we've got to go, have to go this afternoon. In Luke's writings, this village is a bit of an anomaly, because what we do know is that in the next village, he's obviously accepted, because we're told they go on to another village. It's also interesting, the text doesn't say, but the disciples take it to be a personal rejection, and they impulsively ask if they should command fire to destroy them. And in our text that was on the screen, there was a little note, which I normally take them out, but I left it in, because the note is that some manuscripts add, just as Elijah did. It's referring to Elijah calling down fire upon the soldiers of the evil king Azekiah, who ruled the northern kingdom of Samaria. Here we go. Elijah answered the captain, "If I am a man of God, may fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men." Then fire fell from heaven and consumed the captain and his men. And the same thing happens two more times. It's interesting because, of course, the disciples are indignant, but maybe overstepping the power and authority that they have. I wonder if they could have even done that. But what of us when we feel rejected or ignored? When our personal pericope, our personal story seems to be going badly? Are those the times when we suddenly start trying to walk away from God? James demonstrated temper and a desire to retaliate. Is that how we behave when we feel slighted? Or we haven't received what we think of as what we're owed? My dues, that should rightly be mine, whether it be time or praise or reward. Jesus has singled out three of his 12 disciples for special training. There's James, his brother John, and Peter. And whilst James enjoys being in this inner circle, he totally misunderstood Jesus' purpose. He still thought in terms of an earthly king who would defeat the Romans. The NIV Study Application Bible says he'd found the right leader even though he was on the wrong timetable. Are we ever like that? Following Jesus but with the wrong motives? Following Jesus but expecting a power trip? Following Jesus but on our terms, only when it's convenient? So, what do we really get from this story? Well, you might think of Samaria as clearly a touchstone for failure or rejection. And, you know, if you were putting a bookmark on it, that might be it. It's the place where things seem to go wrong. But actually, it's the exact opposite. Thanks to the testimony of the woman at the well, Jesus is going to make great inroads in that town of Sychar. The blind man who returns to thank Jesus while the others run off, in Luke 17, is a Samaritan. In Luke, the story of the traveler attacked by robbers, Jesus uses a Samaritan to exemplify hospitality, the story of the Good Samaritan. And after Jesus' crucifixion, his resurrection and ascension, Samaritans will be some of the first to accept Jesus as their Savior. We read about that in Acts. Even John will return and preach the gospel throughout Samaria. Philip Sharper, who's an editor for Orbis Books, says the Christian life is a bit like pilgrims, but even more accurately, he says it's like nomads. And he says this, "A popular church metaphor is that of the people of God on pilgrimage. But a more apt metaphor should be that of the people of God as nomads. Pilgrims know where their journey is headed. Nomads are called to go by uncertain paths to a place that shall be made holy at some indefinite time by something God shall do or say. There is no guide, no guide except a pillar of fire by night and a wind-driven cloud by day, signs and symbols of the Holy Spirit. Little did the disciples know that very soon they would become nomads on the earth, traveling all over, no fixed home, living in often frightening and hostile circumstances as followers of Jesus. But ironically, they and we were also pilgrims, because pilgrims do have a final destination, eternity with God. Peter would become a great speaker. John would become a major writer. James would become the first of the 12 to die for the faith. We're all on a journey with the same ultimate destination, but with different learning curves for each of us. As Michael Rognes puts it, whether we think of ourselves as aliens, strangers, nomads, or pilgrims, it is because we follow Jesus, and that often takes us into new ways of living. And living resolutely is usually the result of three things: praying, listening, and acting with God. Not on our own, but with God. And I just wonder, how good are you and I at doing these three things, at habitually practicing them? And you can take that word practice as either with an S or a C, because it works both ways. The more we do it, the better we become at it. Recognizing the benefit of doing these things, of praying, of listening and acting. And sometimes we get the priority all wrong, don't we? You know, we do the praying and go straight to acting and leave out the listening. Or we do the listening, but we haven't prayed first. So then we wonder why we don't hear anything, because we haven't made our requests. Or we act without praying or listening. It's like going to the gym or playing golf. Membership alone doesn't get results. The membership card in your wallet or your purse doesn't actually achieve anything. You have to keep at it. You have to keep going. You have to keep practicing in order to win the prize, in order to see the change in yourself, in order that you can create change in others and enact the changes that God desires in those around you. Set your face resolutely today to follow Jesus.